The Profile with Premier Christianity Magazine.
Hello, you're listening to Premier Christian Radio. I'm Sam Hales, editor of Premier Christianity Magazine. You've joined us for The Profile, where we sit down with a different Christian every week to hear something of their life story. And I'm really pleased to say that my guest on the show this week is Megan Basham. She is a US-based journalist who's written for The Telegraph, First Things, World Magazine, and many other outlets. And she is the author of a new book, Shepherds for Sale, which alleges that the evangelical church has, quote, traded the truth for a leftist agenda. The book is currently a number one bestseller in many categories and has caused a huge amount of debate online, even in the few weeks since its release. And so I'm delighted to say that Megan is joining us today on The Profile to discuss the book, as well as her wider work, life, and testimony. Megan, welcome to the show.
Well, thanks for having me. I'm happy to be here and to bask in your British accent, which I know you know that whenever you're here, I'm sure all the Americans gush over it. So sounds very chipper and intellectual, and I love it. So grateful to be here.
I'm really pleased to be mistaken for intellectual. That's always a treat. Yeah, that's very kind. It's wonderful to have you on. And we should say at the outset that the book deals with the US evangelical church, and we have many guests on this show from that portion of the church. So that's really what we'll be discussing. Rather than me wading into all of the detail of the book and the criticism and the online controversy, let's just start at the beginning. I'd love to hear from you. What are the basics of what you're alleging and what you're arguing in this book that has caused so much debate already?
So I would say that the log line, if you will, is that I trace how individual high-profile evangelical leaders and evangelical institutions have started to bring in left-wing ideologies, in part because of explicitly transactional arrangements with secular left foundations who have been funding their groups and funding some individuals, and also how they have traded the truth for a leftist agenda for less concrete receipts, things like, say, media adulation or Tony appointments to think tanks and things of that nature. So there has been a lot of controversy over the title, and a little bit of that, I think, has been disingenuous. But I think, you know, Shepherds for Sale can be both literal and figurative, and that's how I use it.
The book starts with climate change as an example of where you feel some evangelical leaders have gone in a particular direction politically. And is the concern there that sometimes the language might appear to be biblical and we care for creation, the environment, but actually behind that is a particular political view of how we solve that issue rather than necessarily entirely biblically or theologically based?
Yeah, and I think that I really tease that out in the chapter. It's not about Christians taking different points of view on, is climate change an existential crisis? To what degree is it caused by human activity? The bigger issue is how some of these secular left foundations funded evangelical front groups. And I gave the example of the Evangelical Environmental Network, which has taken a lot of money from the Clinton Foundation, the Rockefellers, the Tides Foundation. And they specifically backed very particular legislation, cap and trade carbon emission regulations, for example. And in doing that, they have argued that this is something that Christians need to do to love your neighbor. Or even I highlight one professor saying that this is part of what we need to do to be faithful to the gospel. So at that point, we've moved from something that is Christians debating a legitimately debatable issue into something that's far more legalistic.
You say in the acknowledgments of the book that this has been a passion project of yours for some time, some years. And, you know, you're a writer, you're a journalist, you write on all sorts of different topics. So what is it about this topic, this idea that evangelical leaders are going in a left-wing political direction that so animates you? You've chosen to write a book. You could have written a book on anything. Why this?
You know, it was one of those things that, one, I could not write about it. I have an extremely evangelical background. I grew up as an evangelical Christian. As I give my testimony in the book, I actually came to faith, though, I believe, in my early 20s. But from that point, I worked for evangelical organizations. My kids went to a Christian school. We're now homeschooling. And of course, we're very involved in our evangelical church. So pretty much all the spheres of my life intersect with my faith in a really overwhelming way. So it's not just somebody, hey, this is my church, this is where I attend. There was no getting away from these issues for me. And when I saw these things coming in, and I think like a lot of people, right around 2019, 2020, I experienced those fault lines that Vodi Bakum wrote about in his best-selling book, Fault Lines, where suddenly these issues were being brought into the church in a way that were setting off alarm bells in my mind. One particular example was the church we were at then, that the children's ministry director in 2020 sent out an email about how we could talk to our kids about their white privilege. And, you know, for me, that was a record scratch moment where I went, I don't know that I agree that my kids have white privilege. And I don't know that this is something that I want the children's ministry director at my church sending out without any of us having had a discussion about this issue. So those were the kind of things that really prompted me to start writing about it. And I wrote some articles that went fairly viral, particularly in COVID and related to how the U.S. handled COVID mandates, lockdowns, vaccinations, and how the church participated in that. And at that point, it really felt like I didn't have a plan that I'm going to write about this book. I'm just really passionate about the topic. But it felt to me like God just kept opening doors and I walked through them. A publisher approached me and said, I think this is a good book. You should do a book on this. And so I just went, yeah, okay, yeah, let's do it.
You mentioned COVID. That's another subject that comes out in the book. I think for a lot of church leaders here, there was this concern about this virus that was new, felt like new territory. A lot of church leaders feeling, well, I want to, you know, protect my congregation. And if all of the advice that's coming at me, whether it be medical or government, is we need to lock it down. Okay, let's take church online. That's a price I'm willing to pay. Now, clearly not all church leaders thought that, but that was a mainstream view, certainly here in the UK. It's interesting now looking back and reflecting with the benefit of hindsight, people might see things differently. What's your view on how the church responded to COVID? And do you think the church got it wrong in hindsight?
I do. I think the church got it wrong in a lot of cases. And it wasn't so much about individual congregations deciding, for us, we have prayed through it. We feel convicted that this is the right way to handle it. It was more the top-down argumentation that this is what churches must do to be faithful. And there wasn't that room for personal liberty or for other churches to come to a different conclusion. And one of the examples I give in the book is this question of love your neighbor, get the shot. And that was an actual statement that was put out by National Institutes of Health, Francis Collins, his organization, BioLogos, put out this statement. It was signed by a whole lot of evangelical luminaries. And making that argument turned it into something that was conscience binding, because I had no argument with anybody who felt, hey, I want to get this vaccination. I think it's the right thing to do. I feel convicted that it's the thing for me to do. It was this leveraging of spiritual manipulation to try to tell people that they had to do this. And I gave an example of a lot of reasons why people might not have wanted to do that. If you were a young woman of childbearing age or you were trying to get pregnant, you could very understandably go, I don't know how this could affect my fertility. So I don't know that I need to love my neighbor through getting this shot. And yet we had churches here where young women like that who worked in the nursery, they were fired. They lost their jobs. And I think that that was a legitimate point of critique, that it was assumed that whatever was coming from the federal government was what churches needed to get on board with. And even more explicitly, you saw churches and some very high profile evangelical leaders turning over their influence, turning over their authority to the federal government, but that they were doing this and saying all churches must do this to be faithful.
Some of what you're saying reminds me of some of the statements we had in this country around Brexit, which of course continues to be a contentious issue. And not everyone would agree with this, but one of the things I observed was people alleging that, for example, the bishops in the Church of England, the kind of institutional church hierarchy, had a pretty liberal view, or, you know, in this case, what it wanted to vote to remain, to stay in the EU. And actually, you look at the numbers around this, and you can really make the argument that those in the pews were far more likely to vote Brexit, to vote leave. So you had this disconnect between the church hierarchy, the church leadership, the church institutionally, and the people in the pews. And you know, say some of the statistics does seem to sort of bear that out. And it sounds like you're alleging something similar, in that you would have millions of American evangelicals who think one thing, but perhaps don't feel like they have those spokespeople, whether it's in the media or in an institution, who are willing to say sometimes what seems like the more contentious view. I mean, the other example which we can draw on here is, you mentioned in the book, actually an interview we at Premier Christianity did with Rick Warren, where we asked Rick Warren his views on sexuality. And I think it's fair to say that we had to ask Rick two or three times before he'd really answer the question. And, you know, to be fair to him, maybe he is thinking, do I really want to go there? Do I really want to cause a tweet storm over my views on homosexuality? And there's this kind of reluctance sometimes from the church hierarchy to say things that people in the pews really believe. Does that match with some of your reporting and your view on what's going on here, that there's a disconnect between those in the pews and their leadership?
Yeah, absolutely. And what you just described, and I didn't know that over Brexit, but that is very analogous to what we've seen in the U.S. on any number of issues. And I think part of what you got at there with Rick Warren is this unwillingness to speak plainly in ways that seem culturally disreputable. And I think that's part of why we have seen Rick Warren, before he passed away, Tim Keller. I think that they probably have very orthodox views on sexuality and marriage, but there has been an unwillingness to speak in a way that the common man has no problem misunderstanding. And so instead, they're not doing that. And I think we have to ask why. And when I get at that, part of what I get at is that that currency of respectability within these elite institutions and organizations that so many of these evangelical leaders have come to circulate in. And I think that's part of what we're seeing.
I should say at this point, of course, Rick Warren is not currently here to defend himself,
right,
but perhaps
right.
next time we speak to him, I can put this point to him and indeed some of the other leaders that we interview, because it is a trend, I suppose, that you're alleging that applies, as you say, to a number of different leaders. You know, to answer that question you just put back of why is this happening, does it have anything to do, in your view, with this idea of cancel culture, this idea that, well, if I were to go on Twitter and say what millions of Christians believe, say on sexuality or trans, that actually there could be a pile-on of thousands of people? And the reason I ask that is, this is something you've experienced personally. Since the book was released, you have had piles on of thousands of Christians criticizing you. I imagine every time you load up the Twitter app or the X app, you're probably seeing everything ranging from praise to criticism to probably a level of abuse as well. So you know what it's like to be in the middle of one of these Twitter storms. Do you understand why a church leader might think in an interview, yeah, I'm not really going to answer that question on sexuality, because I don't want the pile-on?
I understand the instinct. I think that's an illegitimate explanation of why one would not do that, for a number of reasons. One, because biblically we're told to expect that if we speak truth, there's going to be a significant portion of the world that doesn't like it and reacts angrily. And I don't see a model either in Christ or in the apostles where we avoid saying just very clear truths because it's going to upset the local populace. So I don't think that's a legitimate argument, but I think that you're right, that is part of why we're seeing it. And I don't think you have to go on Twitter and say it, but let's say if you're sitting down with a journalist and they ask you, is homosexuality still a sin biblically? And is it a legitimate reason for a denomination to split? I don't think you should beat around the bush on that. I think, in fact, that's an opportunity to speak clearly in a culture that lacks a lot of clarity on these issues. And part of why we do that is because you don't know who could be listening. And confidence in your positions itself can be persuasive. And in a very real sense, I feel like so much leadership in the church has focused on this winsome, even going back a little further, seeker-sensitive approach, that they have forgotten the persuasiveness of unapologetic clarity.
I was going to ask what your hopes are for the book, and maybe that's one of them, just that you want Christianese to be a bit more confident and bolder in what they say.
Yeah, absolutely. And part of what I want is I also want us to remove politicking from the church where the Bible doesn't speak. So I think there are issues that are unequivocally biblical issues. If we're talking about the definition of marriage or what a man or a woman is or the sanctity of human life. So I'm not suggesting that the Bible doesn't speak to political issues and even more complex political issues where we say, okay, what should our immigration policy be? I think the Bible does speak to that. My problem is when we have simplified it to a degree that is legalistic and that isn't bringing in the full text of Scripture. So if you're doing something like, say, okay, the church needs to back this particular border policy because welcome the stranger, I think that's spiritual manipulation and abuse of scripture, because we also have passages where if you look in the Old Testament, the way that Israel approached those it was welcoming required cultural assimilation. So what would that mean for us? So it doesn't mean that we don't have these conversations, but it does mean we don't wield them as a hammer and pretend that there's nothing complex and that there aren't legitimate debates to be had within these subjects.
I think some people might be surprised to hear that you're alleging there's this sellout to the left wing. Because I think for a lot of Christians who look at in the UK, who look at America, they would see a selling out to the right. They would see a lot of evangelicals identifying so closely with the Republican Party, willing to back someone like Donald Trump, who a lot of Christians in this country would view as being just very immoral in his personal life. And they'd struggle to understand. It seems like the general flow of traffic here is not towards the left. It's actually towards the right. Do you recognize that at all?
Well, I do, but there's two things I would say to that. One is that we can't pretend that there is a moral equivalency between the policies of the GOP and the policies of the Democrats. Now, I say that as someone who is extremely pro-life and is extremely grieved and unhappy about the turn that the GOP has taken in recent months with regard to the issue of life and how they have dropped that clear language that I advocate in the party platform when it comes to protecting the unborn. So I'm very unhappy with that. I'm unhappy with Donald Trump's recent statements. But at the same time, you have to acknowledge that you have one party that is still at least saying, we are making room for you to continue to push to protect unborn lives. And you have another party that is saying, we are going to do everything we can to ensure that abortion access is available all the way up to birth. And even if a baby survives an abortion, in that case, you're welcome to not provide care and let that baby die. So these are two really distinct moral issues, which is not to say I think Christians have to support the GOP. I've been really careful through all of my commentary and through my book to not get that impression, because I don't believe that. I certainly have friends who feel that in their conscience they need to sit out, they need to vote third party. I understand that. But if someone's asking me, why is there such an alignment between American Christians and the GOP, that is the main reason.
It's because of abortion.
Yeah, and there's a huge, but also if you look at the sexuality issues, if you look at the marriage issues, I mean, there's a lot of us that we go, we are way too conservative for the conservatives, supposedly, because we are still social issue conservatives who believe that marriage is between a man and a woman. And because it's the societal building block, we still think our government should only recognize that.
I noticed in the examples you gave just then, you talked about people sitting out, not voting or voting third party. You didn't say, though, that a Christian could vote Democrat. So do you not think then that a Christian, because this issue of abortion and pro-life is so key for you and so important, you feel like a Christian just could never vote for the Democrats because of their abortion policy?
Yeah, I think that's a morally illegitimate choice. And I wouldn't say that if there were still blue dog Democrats who are pro-life, but we can also look at how the party has driven anyone who even hints at the fact that they might still be pro-life out of the party. So if you are telling me I got a local candidate who's a Democrat, I happen to agree with the larger social safety net or something like that, but this is a pro-life candidate who is not for transgender treatments on children or having pornographic books in our libraries in the kids section, I can agree with that person and go, yeah, in that case, sure. But if you're telling me I'm looking, for example, at the policies that the Harris Walls ticket are putting forward, no, I actually don't think that's a morally legitimate position for a Christian.
It's a really interesting one, because for Christians in the UK, we don't have the luxury, frankly, of any of the main parties that would really stand on what the average Christian would perceive to be a pro-life view. And so for Christians in the UK, we've always, I think, had to, dare I use the word, compromise. But in politics, that's what politics is about, right? You have to compromise a little bit. You're never going to find a party or a politician that completely backs everything you believe in. And again, I put it to you that a lot of Christians look at American evangelicalism, they say, you are in bed with one side. It's not the left, it's the right.
Well, part of what I would say is what you just said, is that they are backing the right, they're not backing the left. And when you actually look at the numbers, evangelicals don't tend to support Trump anymore. Like, it's maybe 1 or 2 percentage points. So within the margin of error, any more than they supported Mitt Romney, John McCain, George W. Bush. So one, I think it's a little bit of a misnomer to suggest that evangelicals are flocking to Donald Trump in a way that they didn't in the past. They're pretty much doing what they've always done. But I totally see your point in terms of if you're in the UK and you say, this is the spectrum of choices we have always had. And unfortunately, I think we're heading that direction ourselves in the US when you look at what the GOP is doing now on its language on abortion. So the moral calculus can change, but I don't think the foundational argument of going, okay, we have to choose the most moral option that we can get as Christians. And I think that's where the disconnect is that you can go, I'm not happy with these choices that we have, but I have to steward my vote in the way that best reflects a set of biblical ethics. And it may not reflect it very well at all, but you do the best that you can.
Well, the book is Shepherds for Sale. It's out now. And we need to talk, Megan, about the online commentary, which has been unlike anything I can remember around any Christian book for a long time, which I think is partly why we're talking. As I say, the book does deal with America and the US, and it's interesting to see where there might be crossover and what's happening here in the UK. I want to ask a personal question first, though, which is how do you respond when you see the amount of critique and criticism and upset the book has caused? I mean, do you have a thick skin over these things, or has it been hard to deal with at times?
Well, you know, a few things. One, I knew going in that I was kicking a hornet's nest in a sense because I had been writing on these issues. And I knew that what had happened, even in just the articles I did that went viral, is that there would be a groundswell of support from ordinary people in the pews. And that is why I even got the book deal, for example, because there was that support. But then on the other side, there would be a lot of entrenched resentment among what you might call the institutional class pushing back. So I was under no illusions that when the book came out, I wouldn't see that pattern writ large. And I did. And in terms of how I deal with it, one, you do try to go, okay, what's legitimate here in this critique? I do believe that this book has been sifted over and minutely examined in a way that I have never seen with any other book. So there have been a few, what I would say, inadvertent minor errors that, you know, I've made a list and go, okay, we need to correct that. I thought that a government contract covered 1 year, but it actually covered 10 years. So we need to correct that. Or I got where someone graduated from a seminary wrong. But I also think it's disingenuous because any book of this nature with this many citations is going to have a few little things like that. So you've had critics going, this is totally discredited, throw this book out. And I think that that's just an attempt to deflect and try to get people to not read the book. But what I do is I have a sounding board of people that I know to be biblically sound, who I have trusted a lot over the years. And I go to them and I say, okay, what do you think? Do you think I've got this wrong? Did I miss something? My husband is one of those people. My friend Rosaria Butterfield is another of those people, and I have others. So I do use them as sounding boards. And then you also pray through it and you go, Lord, if I've got this wrong, show me, because I don't think I've got it wrong, but I do want to be open to correcting the record if I did. So I push back where I think that I should push back. And if I got something wrong, and so far I don't think I've gotten anything significant wrong, but I'll make a note and tell the editor, hey, we need to correct this going forward in the next printing.
And is that the plan, to make some corrections in the next printing?
Yes, a handful.
Because the accusations here are quite considerable. I mean, Gavin Ortland, pastor quoted in the book, says the book is not truthful. VeggieTales creator Phil Vischer, also quoted in the book, says, quote, multitudinous misquotes, misrepresentations, misattributions in the book. Phil Vischer called it profoundly cynical. You know, it's one thing for people to disagree with the point you're making. It's another thing to question your integrity as a journalist and say you're not even quoting the issues accurately here.
Well, what's funny to me is that if we see this in any other realm, we're not really surprised that the people who are critiqued are objecting to the fact that they're being critiqued. For example, we've been talking about politics, and you see that all the time in politics. Someone will do a story and it creates a negative reaction from the public, and the politician in question will go, well, no, that's not what I meant. And I think that's very much what you're seeing here. So all of the names that you just mentioned are all people who are critiqued in the book. And if you look at someone like Phil Vischer and his commentary on abortion, he has absolutely said what I said he said in the book. So he has argued that the abortion debate in the U.S. needs to be more nuanced. And in fact, he has even said, and I did not quote this in the book, that he thinks there may be some room in the first trimester or for the particular cases of rape and incest for allowing abortion. So when you point this out, he goes, yeah, but I don't like that citation that she used.
Where do you think this conversation will go next? Yeah, there's been so much commentary over it. The book's doing incredibly well. You've very much succeeded in starting a conversation. And dare I say it, some of the controversy, dare I say it, might even help some of the sales. That's, you know, you and I work in media. We know how this stuff works. But where do you think the conversation will go next? Because, you know, it's very much begun, but I'm interested to hear your view on what do you think might happen.
Well, I think the conversation goes forward. I certainly don't intend to be done writing about this subject. And I can tell you so much of what has happened ended up on the cutting room floor. But at the same time, I have seen a shift in the Overton window within evangelicalism that I'm taking as a positive for those of us who have been sounding the alarms. It has been a win, even though there's some frustration. You will see some people who you know were over here sort of advocating more left-wing ideologies over whatever the particular issue was. It might be Black Lives Matter or gun control. And all of those are things that we can debate, but we know what they were advocating at that time. And suddenly a lot of those sermons, those essays are getting memory holes. Not only have some of them been taken down and disappeared and they're only available now on the Wayback Machine, you're seeing a lot of people go, I never supported critical race theory. And in a way, that's frustrating because as a journalist, you go, that's not true. You absolutely did. But on the other hand, that is a signal to me that maybe the fever has broken and we're moving away from some of this ideology coming into the church because so many people now want to distance themselves from it. So I expect to see that continue. But also, I would like to see some lessons learned. So much of what I cover is a pattern of some flashpoint happens in the dominant culture, whether it's the Me Too movement or it is the Black Lives Matter movement, and you see the church rush to find a way to repackage it in a churchy way and give some Christianese terms to it and then say, we're on board too. And that's the problem of the pattern that I see is just this constant desire to go, how do we keep up with the culture rather than how do we be distinct from the culture? And we are timeless and eternal, and we don't get caught up in whatever this latest craze in society is. So I would really like to see a moment where we stop doing that, that we don't need to join up with whatever the latest thing is.
Yeah, it's a challenge to those Christians who kind of seek what's been termed cultural relevancy, this idea that we have to, as you say, just follow the culture, whereas I think the challenge for us as Christians is what we believe goes back a very long time and it stands the test of time, actually. It doesn't need to be on the cultural pulse of whatever's happening right now. We've got so much more history and tradition behind us that, the gospel is already relevant. We don't need to make it relevant somehow.
Which isn't to say that we don't need to make it relevant. And it's not to say that we don't have things to say to these moments that are culturally relevant. I think the issue is when we try to position ourselves where the culture is. So I absolutely believe scripture has a lot to say to all of these issues. The problem is when we're ignoring scripture in order to sort of go, okay, but here's how we can be in the same position and have the same outlook. So that's where I object. And I do think hopefully, if I have my way, this book will help church leaders maybe pull back from that. It will help people in the pews be more discerning and embolden some people when they see this happening in their churches and their institutions to raise their voice, not in a combative way, not in a disrespectful way, but to graciously say, hey, I have some concerns about this. Can we go out to coffee? Can we talk about this? So in all of the storm of controversy, I do feel like it's been a little exaggerated what I'm calling for or what I said. I'm like, I'm certainly not saying leave your churches and go after your pastor with pitchforks. Absolutely not saying that. We need to be in churches. We need good leaders and we all fail and we all get some things wrong. And so part of what we need to do is have these conversations openly and graciously.
That's good to hear. We're all about that as well here at Prima Christianity, you know, having grace in our conversations. I wonder, you've arguably done something pretty brave in the Christian world, which is to name names and to say, well, I think it's this Christian leader, you know, publicly has said this or this Christian organization has said this. It doesn't tend to happen a lot in the Christian world. And I think sometimes that is because of our concern around unity, We want to be speaking well of each other. We want to be slow to criticize other Christian leaders. Clearly, you felt like enough has happened and you had such a concern. You felt it necessary to name these names. You know, how would you push back against a Christian who thinks, I don't like the sound of this, you know, attacking other Christians by name in a book? This feels like the church airing its dirty laundry in a public book, which some Christians are a bit turned off by that idea. I wonder what you'd say to them.
Right. And I think part of the reason that things got to what I would call an epidemic level of compromise with a lot of these progressive ideas and influences was because we were unwilling to say, here's who's doing it. I do think there were some voices warning people who were well-known pastors saying that it's happening, but they didn't want to say who was doing it. And that allowed it to continue. So one, we're both journalists, and you go journalistically, you need to say who's doing what. You need to make your case, and you can't do that without being specific. You need to cite your sources. You need to give your citations. And so I do that so people can look at all of those and examine them and decide for themselves, is this legitimate? Do I think that this particular pastor was using his influence this way, or was he really making these arguments? And then the other part of it is I think it's biblical. We see the Apostle Paul airing some dirty laundry, not just with the famous encounter with Peter and those who were wanting to bring in legalistic Jewish law and add it to grace. But we also see him doing it with people who we have no idea today who they were. But we know that Paul had some issues with things that Alexander the coppersmith was doing. We know that in his letters to Timothy, he had issues with some of the teaching that Alexander and Hymenaeus were putting out. And I don't know what that teaching is, but we know even today that when we read those letters, Paul was saying, these two men are teaching error and we need to be on our guard against it. And so I think that model is part of what I wanted to reflect, is that this is a biblical way to have this conversation. Now, when you name names, you don't attack. I reject that this is an attack. It's documentation. And so you don't say things that are untrue, and I don't believe that I have. You don't name call. You don't get nasty, but you are forthright about it.
Which of these topics has not been covered on PremierChristianity.com? UFOs, near-death experiences, Doctor Who, Christ's return, the faith of celebrities, and Andrew Tate? Trick question. We don't shy away from any topic. We cover faith as it affects us in daily life and give you the bigger picture. PremierChristianity.com. Special podcast subscription offer at PremierChristianity.com/podcast.
I'd love to hear a bit more about your own story, your own journey to faith. Did you grow up in a Christian household?
I did, yes. And I concluded the book with my testimony in part because we have seen so much, almost a cottage industry of books, largely from the left, attacking the church. Christian Dumais, Jesus and John Wayne, a lot of other books of that nature. And so I gave my testimony because I wanted people to know I love the church. I want to build up the church. I'm not here to tear down the church. So that was why I gave a little bit of my personal story.
And how would you say your faith has changed over time from a child to today? You know, what stayed the same and what's different?
Well, I'm one of those Christians, because I grew up in a Christian home, I can't pinpoint the moment and go, this is when I was saved. But I think I know. And I don't believe, even though I grew up in a Christian home, that I was a Christian until my early 20s. So like so many kids who grew up in a Christian home, I went away to college, a secular university, and kind of went wild, had a very prodigal experience. It dealt with a lot of substance abuse, drug abuse, alcohol abuse. I've jokingly said that the colloquial way to put it is a bit of a party girl. But a lot of ugliness and sin comes along with those things. And that was all endemic to my life at that time. And it's a long story, and I do tell it in the book, but through an experience with the quest for the Holy Grail, I actually, in that moment, there, for those who don't know, in the original Vulgate cycle, there are all of these hermits who come out and confront Lancelot over his sin with Guinevere. And it's not this romantic thing. It's not this star-crossed love. It's you're engaged in gross sin, and you are absolutely wasting all of the advantage that your parents and God gave to you. And when I read these, I just experienced this moment of clarity where I went, oh my gosh, this is me. This is how I'm living. And you know, it was years ago, but I prayed in that moment. I got down on my knees. I just, you know, prayed, Lord, help. I'm living this wasted life. And that was when I think I came to Christ. I don't know. Because if you'd asked me before that, I would have said I was a Christian too, but I certainly wasn't living like I was, and I had no sustained interest in spiritual things. And then after that, there was a process of sanctification, because when you come out of a really sinful lifestyle, it can take a little time. And I spent some months kind of doing the Christian therapy thing, where I had people saying, well, you're still struggling with the sin because of the trauma in your background, which is true. I did have trauma in my background. But it wasn't helping me not sin. And then I came across John MacArthur's writings, who I'm assuming probably a lot of, even in the UK, a lot of people will know John MacArthur and his writing.
Absolutely. Yes, he's been broadcast his sermons on Premier Christian Radio many times. We know John MacArthur well. Yes.
Well, so his book, The Vanishing Conscience, was just a light switch for me. And he just said, you know, basically, and I'm not quoting him, this is my paraphrase, but, you know, all God's creatures got problems. We have all been sinned against. We have all done a lot of sinning, and the way to address these issues is to fix your eyes on Christ and take hold of that new creation you are, and choose to stop sinning, because you now have the power to do that. And that just changed my life entirely. And so from there, I met my husband, and, you know, it was kind of just an ongoing process of sanctification and walking with the Lord. And that's part of why I go, I think that was the moment, because after that, I never departed again.
An amazing story. It's so interesting what you say about, I guess, for a lot of Americans thinking, oh yeah, I'm a Christian, and this kind of cultural Christianity. And I always find it interesting, because Americans tell me, well, we feel like our country is becoming more secular, more godless, and I hear that. But for a Brit who visits America, I think this is still a very Christian culture compared to where I'm from. And I speak to Americans, I say, can make evangelism quite hard when a lot of your country think they're Christians already, and they haven't quite had that moment of encounter of realizing I need to be born again, need to give my life to God. And being a Christian is not just because I was born in America or I go to church once a year. There's more to it than that. Now, have you noticed that in the culture, that sometimes you almost have to convince someone they're not actually a Christian before you could really give them the true gospel?
Yes. And when we look back historically, I don't think that's necessarily new. It feels new. But if you look at Jonathan Edwards and the reaction to the sinners in the hands of an angry God sermon, you were also dealing with a highly churched culture, a much more churched culture than we have today. And yet it still impacted people, because he came forward and confronted this. You may think that you're a believer, but if this is how you are living and you have none of these marks of being a true Christian, then this is the danger of hell that you're in. And part of why I think that we have this cultural Christianity, because everybody, you know, just kind of thinks they're a Christian because they do these things, is because we don't speak in those stark terms anymore. And we don't really bring the warnings of hell and damnation. Those are very uncomfortable topics. And, you know, not to be a fire and brimstone person, but I do think we need to bring that back into our discussion a little bit more to help those who are just culturally Christian. And, you know, I kind of reject that term generally, but those who think they're Christian because they're in a Bible Belt culture, which we're in, understand, no, just thinking you live well, or let's go to Donald Trump saying, I can't remember what he just said in that recent interview where I think I'm a Christian because, and it was something that was entirely unbiblical. And you went, no, you definitely don't get what the gospel is. And I think it would help if maybe some of these Christians who are around Donald Trump would explain to him, here's why you're wrong. You thinking you're a good person is not getting you into heaven. And it's clear that he misunderstands that.
You say, you know, you love the church, you care about the church. Are you optimistic or pessimistic about the future of the church in the U.S.?
In some ways, I think this conversation that has started happening about cultural Christianity is a good thing, because I think it's good for even those who are not believers, like Jordan Peterson or Richard Dawkins or Elon Musk, to recognize the positive impact that the gospel has on a culture. I think that's an opening that you can then walk into and say, let me tell you why that is. But beyond that, I don't know. I don't like to be a prognosticator on those things. I know this. I know that, you know, the gates of hell are not going to stand against the church. So I'm always optimistic about the future of the church. I just, you know, I don't know about the United States. And that's why we pray and we try to be faithful in our spheres to proclaim the gospel and speak truth wherever we can.
I imagine this book and the book's release has probably created lots of new opportunities and avenues for you to potentially walk down in your own life and career. What are your career aspirations going forward? What does the future look like to you, for you? And I suppose my question as well, not only is what the future look like, but do you have a different view of that future having released this book and thinking there are other avenues I could walk down now?
Yeah, it definitely feels like things have taken a turn that I wasn't expecting. So I don't know. You know, I didn't plan for this to happen. I didn't plan to end up at the Daily Wire. I didn't plan to write this book or these articles. So I kind of feel like I just, I go, okay, Lord, I don't know. Whatever's next, I'm ready.
Well, Megan Basham, thank you so much for joining us on The Profile this week. The book is out now. It's called Shepherds for Sale, available wherever books are sold. But Megan, it's been great to chat.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me.
You've been listening to The Profile in association with Premier Christianity Magazine.